Welcome to Veterans Voices UK, the podcast where we bring you the remarkable stories of British military veterans from across the generations. In each episode, you'll hear the voices of those who've served our country, from the heroes of the Second World War to those who fought in more recent conflicts. But these aren't just war stories, they're stories of life and the lasting impact the military service has on those who lived through it. I'm Matt Lim, and today I'm honoured to introduce Peter Franklin, a proud son of County Durham. Peter's story is part of a much wider family tradition of army service and hard work. He tells us about his father and his time in the Territorial Force before 1914, then serving in the Great War, where he was badly injured. His brother too carried scars of a different kind, suffering a broken back working in the Durham coalfield, the same pit life that shaped so many families in that part of the country. Against this backdrop, Peter began his own journey. His national service took him to Malaya with the Hussars during the Malayan Emergency, an experience that marked the start of a long association with the Army. After returning home, he continued his service, following the family tradition within the Territorial Army, where he remained active and busy until the 1980s. But soldiering is only one part of Peter's life. Away from the uniform, his lifelong passion has been cycling. From the rolling roads of County Durham to rides across Europe, through Austria, Ireland, and even the Alps, Peter has always found freedom and purpose on two wheels, a pursuit that has shaped his life almost as much as his many years in the Army. So thank you for listening to Veterans Voices UK. Now let's hear from Peter Franklin, as his story begins reflecting on some of his earliest childhood memories.
Actually, I can't remember the house at all. I have been back, and it was 9 Double Row, Eldon. It's demolished now, it's gone. But I can only remember being taken out by my brothers and sisters in a push, waste, you know, wouldn't it would be a pram then? And my brother, my oldest brother was 17. And I remember my mum had said, can they take the man out for an hour, just while I get finished? So he took me out in the pram. And he said, he's going in the world. And somebody said, why, he doesn't have look like his dad. I remember a lady called Mrs. Rowley, Ma Rowley, I called her. And she was from Leeds, she was a Yorkshire person. She lived in the next street. And I do believe, because my mother had such a hard time, she'd lost the little girl, and she was in a really bad way. And I used to go to her house, and she looked after me. I can remember that. She's a very nice person. I did go to see her after I was more or less grown up, you know. And she was still the same person, only much older. And she was going to live with one of her daughters in Leeds. So I never saw her after that, you know, but she was a very nice person. And then we moved to Bishop Auckland. I can't remember the address. But anyway, we moved to Bishop Auckland. It was a rented house in Little Turris behind the Grand Hotel at Bishop Auckland. And I went to school from there to St. Wilfrid's, a Catholic school at Bishop Auckland. I'd only been there a few months, I think. We moved again. We hadn't lived there in that address because it was a free house. My dad would get at Alton Park to see, being the colliery, and then they got the coal delivered and everything else. So it was like that. And of course, being at school at Bishop Auckland, I used to have to walk to school. It was 2.5 miles to Bishop, so I couldn't walk it. And I went to that little school, and it was a good school. But as soon as the priest must have been not in my mother constantly.
Yeah.
And I ended up transferring as soon as I was 7, I think, or 6 or so, and I walked to Bishop every day till I was 14.
Peter, am I right in thinking that your family, I think you said it there, were miners all through their life? I mean, so was Dad, what kind of man was Dad? And, you know, what was a character was your dad, and what do you remember?
Lucky, a little stomach, though. Yeah, strong, you know. And see, then the fathers never took the kids out then. They went to the club on an afternoon, on a Saturday and Sunday afternoon, and you sat and waited for your dinner till they came back. And I vowed, this is one thing I said, that when I was married and had kids, I would never wait for the Sunday, and they never did.
And am I right in thinking that Dad, despite being a miner, he actually served in World War One? Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah?
He served with the TA. I don't know what it was called, TA or militia. I think it was TA. And naturally, it was extra money, you know. I don't know how long he was in the TA before he went to France. But they were trained soldiers, you know what I mean? They weren't recruits. It's only what I've read about after that. Because I always thought he was in France for a long time, and he wasn't. He was back in hospital within 2-3 months of him going into France. And of course, that was it was the first engagement, I think, when he got wounded.
And which regiment was Dad with? Do you know?
6th Battalion, Air Company, 6th Battalion.
Of the DLI, Drum Light Infantry, yeah. So Dad served. Who, do you know any other uncles or anybody else who served during World War One, Peter?
Well, I only said, naturally, I only know him and my uncle, but there were chaps in the village who had served quite a few, you know.
And what about your uncle? Do you know where your uncle served? Was that your mum's brother?
He served in the Dardanelles, as he called it, Gallipoli. I think he did about 2 years.
What I'd like to do then is move on a little bit now to work, you know, as you left school. And what was the first job you went to, and where did you actually go to work?
I was in a place called Wilson's Forge, but it became Wilson's Foundry after that, but it was Wilson's Forge. And it was a firm that made stuff for the coal mines, nearly all of it. I was an apprentice moulder, ended up just making two wheels and bits for the thingy. Never given tuition by an older chap. The only tuition you got was the first day when you went under moulding, and that, because it was just like making sandpies, you know.
What was it you actually made while you were there? What did you actually make? What was it you were making?
Wheels for various countries.
So it was for the mining industry.
All for the mines.
All for the mines.
Crossing chairs, you know, where they put the lines in.
So you didn't want to follow your father and go down the pit then?
I had no choice. They never said, well, my father was died then, and my brothers, the thing that where definitely I wasn't going down, I had a brother who was 20, and it was a Friday, and his mate, Bill Scarlett, he said to me, I've got a heavy date on Friday night, and I'm on, I don't know what shift it was, but he's at work. He said, "Will you swap us?" And he said, owe me a pint, man. So he went into work on a Friday night, and we'll never forget it, Miss Carlos, as he was coming now nearly out of the shift, the wall fell in, the roof fell in, and Tweet pinned him, and he had broke his back. He wasn't badly scarred or anything, you know, his back had broken. He went to the hospital at Durham. But you see, the hospitals were full of soldiers. There was nothing much they could do. Now, if he'd been, they could have done something, because his back was broken at the base. And the only thing was that they couldn't do anything for him, so they sent him home with a long wheelchair, you know, a big long one. And he lived for 4 years. They knew that there was no hope for him, but they just sent him home to die.
So, Peter, we move forward now. We've left school. We're busy working at the foundry. And suddenly it's, I think, February 1955 when you got your National Service call-up papers. Can you remember that day?
Well, I got the call just before Christmas, the letter. And in actual fact, I had one man's wage, which was £11, before I went into the army for 28 shillings. I can remember going on the train to Middlesbrough for my exam, medical. And there were some lads out of the Green Howards in the same. They were going from Darlington to Middlesbrough home. They'd done the service. And they said, they were, wasn't you? Because they said, oh, you're dressed up to go for your thing. You put your tie and you're all dressed up. And they said, you don't want to be going where we've been. So he says, we've just come back from bloody Korea. He says, all we'd done is dig bodies up to be reburied, because Korea, the war had finished,
yeah.
And they had to reinter all them that were just. And he says, and it wasn't very nice. So he said, keep out the bloody 3 hours, don't it? Of course, when I went medical, I was okay, you know, and naturally I was okay, year one. And when I went from, I don't know how long it was before I went got the medical, it wasn't that long, about a month probably, called the 67th Turn Regiment, Royal Armoured Corps, Carlisle. Of course, I knew nothing about anything in the army work, apart from not going in the Durham. I don't know why, that was another thing. My mother said, don't go in the Durham. I said, Mother, I have no choice. I go where they put me, and that's it. So, anyway, I went for the interview into the army, and I think he was a colonel, I'm not sure. But I had a mate in the cycling club who volunteered, and he was a skilled man. He was a fitter turner, and he wanted to drive a tank, so he volunteered for the KDGs, Kings of Home Guards. And he came home in all his finery with his chain mail and the lot of them, you know. And he looked at it. He was a tank commander by then, you know. And when I went to that interview, the chap who was interviewing that, and he says, and what would you like to go into? I said, the King of Dragoon Guards. And he said, that one of my best friends is a commander and he likes it. Well, he says, fair enough, that thing. He says, but he said, you haven't no much chance, you know. Cavalry regiments are usually pretty well. Thing says you don't get many national servicemen, so that I didn't know that till I got to the 67th Trail Regiment that there were no tank regiments there. They were all armored cars and Land Rovers, you know, just and it was mainly signalling things, you know, the lot. And I did the bits of exams they give you to do. And I knew that I've never been good at maths, never, ever. And I knew I wouldn't do very good at the maths. And I got the shock of my life when they put, where you were born, Hipswood Lodge High Education Centre, Clark. Well, that's absolutely Steve Walker. And oddly enough, the lad who went to Hipswood Lodge with me, he was a steamroller from Southfields, the same lad. Only he'd had the better look at where the school he went to, they also did clerical work, typing, and our school never had to type right in the school. So we were with the 7 tanks at Wentworth Camp, and Wentworth Camp was a 1914-18 camp then, not now, then. And we were in Nissenhoods, the pot-bellied stove in the middle. And you had one bucket of coal and nobody told you where to get it from. And there were some sticks. So there was a Nissenhut full of us, about 20 euros, went to this course. And they said, well, we're going to have to find out where you get this from. And it was in Catterick Camp. It was a big coal depot. But it was guarded. That's a guard. Because the regiment in charge then was Thick Skins, the Inner School of the World. And they had guards round. But what happened was, we went and we saw the lads out the skims, and we said, you go on for getting coal. And he says, we have a roller. And he said, although we're guarding the place, we have no bloody coal either. So he said, there's a pierce at the back where you'll get in. But he said, you'll have to wait until we tell you, because the guard will not be there. So it was enjoyable, really. He put a bit of excitement in you. And after, we had the one parade, it was something to do with blood. If you gave a pint of blood, you got a 48. We were going to pint of blood. And this chap, he kept coming around and looking at us all. Because we were all armoured car, we weren't skins. And he says, I know why I've seen you about that. He says, near my farm. Why, he wasn't the farm, he was master of foxhounds for the skins, you know. He says, I live on that hill where you go to pinch the wood from. And we said, oh. He says, I'm saying that I know that I've seen you all this. I don't know who you are. And he says, I know it's you lot that's taking my fencing and using it. He says, and really speaking, he said, I have no nothing against you for pinching the wood because you've got valid. But he said, if I really catch you, he's valid, he said. I always loved him when he was a good bloke, really, you know. And he says, I love you, I catch you. So, and he's good.
It must have been amazing then, Peter, that, you know, you came from a mining family where, you know, part of your dad's wages is a load of coal every month that's delivered to you. And you join the army, you go and take the, you know, as it was then, the Queen's shilling and put your hand up and volunteer, and you almost have to steal your own coal to keep you warm.
Yeah. Mine before that, when my mother was widowed and the oldest brother wasn't old and he had to be 18 to get the coal delivered. And we just, it stopped the coal. And until my brother was 18, we didn't get it. But we used to go down to the sidings and there was always coal laid about. And no, nobody ever said anything, you know. I used to sled the sledge with the bag and take it up. It's funny, these things you remember.
Yeah. Where did you go after that, Peter?
I went back to Carlisle.
Yeah.
The Clark's Cross was a pass and a fail in one, two respects. I passed the other one, no bother. They're Britain. They're Kiteman, I didn't pass. I knew I wouldn't because there was too, they put music on and you had to type the music in that and I just couldn't grasp it. And so I was classed as a Clark TV, I thought. And I went back to Carlisle and did fatigues for a while. And we were only fatigues until we were posted out. And we went to Liverpool. And there was a big posting of Welsh, not Welsh Fusiliers, Welsh Regiment. He had a big white coat. And the thing I remembered, and still do to this day, when the troop ship went past Wales, the whole lot got up on the top and sang.
So the ship that you board in Liverpool, it was the Devonshire, and this was taking you out to Malaya. Yeah. Can you remember your time on board ship as you travelled out? Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I happened to get the job of fire picket. Now, our troop deck was split into two. There was 11 lads on one side and medical corps on the other side. And they were absolutely amazed that we had to get every night, get out boots. I would say probably the best boots in the British Army then. I don't know if that's just me. The amount of work we put in, because we had to take them to the troop deck every 2 days, and there was a new officer who knew as much as us, you know, that we didn't know then, but he didn't. And he would look at the boots, but he didn't know what standard was. They were bulled all over, and he had to be spot on. And on the thing that happened to me with the fire picket was, every night an army officer, a naval officer, and an RAF, whatever was on, went and did the rounds of the troop picks. And I had to go with them, and they opened the toilet doors and I said, check, you know, okay. And this particular night, when another troop deck, we did about three, I think, to this deck, nobody there. So he says, trooper, come here, check these. Anybody in? No, sir. Right. Report to the regulator, regulator's office tomorrow morning at 10:30. So there were Navy blokes that were doing that troop deck. And some of the mates, the ladder was missing. So, some of his mates says, are you on the regulators tomorrow? I says, I am. I'm a witness against a bloke who knows who and said, well, he's one of our mates, you see, and he's a nasty bugger, you know. And the story they told me about him, you know, they didn't half have me on. And I was too in cheek at the what the ring there. And they were waiting, and he was there with me. So the marches all there, as they do. And he said, is it true that on the night of so-and-so, you were? Yes, yes. And there was no one in the decks. No, sir. You positive? I said, I am, sir. Because he had no choice. Everybody had seen me. And anyway, he said, okay, march out. So they were going to drink a Malay, and they gave him 5 days' pay when he got there. Nothing on the deck, I don't think they could. And anyway, we saw his mate, you know, that he's not with the African Army. Come with me, my men want to see you, so we went. And they were getting the rum. And they were too getting a rum ration then. And they said, well, because you've been a good witness, we're giving you the rum ration. And that was the first time I'd tasted it. I'd known it at Navy Rum. I'd had Gurkha rum, but not Navy Rum. And they would do have me on all the time, you know. Says, and that's what they do in the army, and that's what they do all over. But of course, I didn't know then. I was a bit green. And we went to Malta, but we only stopped hours there. They did drop somebody off. They were there. And we went to Aden. And another thing happened there. Me and my mate paid easy, they called him. I had a box camera. And we got let off the boat. This was like a two-day stop, Aden. So there was a hill going up. The two trackers and a hill going up that side. So we walked this hill. So we walked up the hill. And there was mostly Arab places that were passed. And there was at the top, there was a woman. And I don't know whether she was making the camera or putting a leather thing around it. So Peter goes, he says, give the camera. And you'll stand beside the camera. And I'll tell you. So and all of a sudden, she shouted like a scream. And go come out with her. And we ran back down the river. And there was an empty jeep at the bottom. He said, what do you mean, dude? We're running away. There's an Arab with a knife up there. He stood at the top of the other. And he said, why? And we said, because they took a photograph of his wife. You don't take photographs of any Arab. You take part of their soul away if you do that. And we said, really? He says, we're not kidding you. You know, they really got you. I said, all right, then if they never tell you these things before you go anywhere, you have to learn them all there. We went to Ceylon after Aden, and Colombo. And of course, the same happens everywhere. You have a lovely place because you have no money, you know, you just have enough to. And they made Pete easier than we made. And we were walking around a bit aimless, and a chap in a suit and a tie, and he was Indian. And he said, oops, gotta go, lads. And we said, well, really, yes. And he says, have you heard of the Cinnamon Gardens? And we said, no. And he says, well, do you mind if I show you them? Because I live here and I like them, you know. And he was a teacher, a retired teacher. And he took us in, and there's a big Buddhist temple. And he took us to this temple, and he explained Buddhism, you know, in layman's words. And he was excellent, you know, really nice chap. And then he showed us all around the Cinnamon Gardens. And he didn't want money or anything. In fact, he would probably have bought us a coffee with us, you know. And he said, yeah, which was a guided tour around the Cinnamon Gardens because we were there for a full day, you know. And the other thing that happened in Colombo, there was a total eclipse of the sun, but ever total, not like we say here, black. Everything just went black and everything stopped. Cars, the thing, and these are things you remember, you know.
So Peter, after an amazing voyage out there with Malta and Aden and Colombo, eventually we arrive in Malaya. Can you remember your time arriving in Malaya?
I remember going right down the straits, the Malacca Straits, and seeing the jungle out of the side and everything. And then we got into Singapore and we went to a camp called Nee Soon Garrison, which was the camp where you went to when you were off the boat. And it was an old camp. It was what they called atap. It's like straw, but it's a lot. It's a leaf. And they were all atap leaf huts. And some of them were infested with many fleas as well. You never all been in before you, you know. And there was a swimming pool there, a bazaar where they were. Naturally, we'd never seen anything like that before. Bazaars there, and we were there for 3 days. And then a chap came out of the 11th Hussars, a corporal, well below, I remember his name. He was taking us up to see, I'll just explain how it worked in then. A regiment usually stays in one big company split. In Malaya, the regiment was split into the country. B squadron was 30 miles from Singapore. A squadron was in Seremban, which was 350 miles up country. There was only three roads. One road up the middle, one road on the left, and one road that went so far up the east coast and then stopped. It's not stopped now, but it was then. The jungle stopped it, that was it. And the third party went to C squadron, which was in Ipoh, which is near the Siam border, up on the top. So we actually called it Siam, it's Thailand. And we all had to go to Seremban because that was the headquarters. Everybody went there first to get indoctrinated. And we went there to Seremban, and Seremban camp was another camp made out of atap, as they called it, atap and bamboo. And it was a very clean, naturally clean, tidy camp, with the toilets and that. It's a thing that people always talk about, even the officers talk about deep drops. Well, I'm heard of the fight, deep drops. He says, mind you don't fall in them deep drops, they'll never see you again.
So, Peter, we arrive in Malaya, we arrive in that reception area, which was essentially climatisation and just preparing you for Malaya. And am I right in thinking you then moved forward up to B Squadron? Yeah?
Now, when you were posted up or down country, you had to be in a guarded compartment. I don't know how they treat the guards. I wasn't picked. I'm out based to say. And there was one eye at the end, Bren gun. And the rifle, because it had been attacked many times over the years, the train, and you used to look at you, nothing happened. I mean, there was always a few shots fired, somebody firing those somewhere, but I mean a proper attack on the thingy. And we were a bit apprehensive at first, but we didn't care. After the first hour, we were all right. And we all had our rifles and all our kit with us. And we got, and I think I remember most of it, it was overnight, going from Seremban to the overnight. So we're going to Singapore about 6 o'clock maybe. And there's a wagon waiting, took us up to B Squadron, which was 30 miles, well, nearly 30 miles out. And yet you went across the causeway, which is the difference between Malaya and Singapore. That time it was only dual carriageway, two roads. Now it's marvellous. We went across there and got into camp, got my gear off, and the adjutant, who was a young Captain Hall, I called him, he eventually became the colonel. And we went in, for the first thing he said to me was, "Have you shaved this morning?" I said, "No, sir, I've been on a trail." "That makes no bloody difference," he says. I said, he said, "Go away, have shaved, and come present yourself to me." He wasn't that nasty. And the next time I went, he says, "That better." He says, "Remember, you had water in your water bottle." I said, "I did, sir, you're right." He says, "And also, there's water on the train, you know." I said, "Well, we stopped where we were, you know." He says, "Oh, go on," he says. He was a nice chap. It became full colonel of the Gloucestershire before he finished. It was good.
Once you docked up to B Squadron and you settled in, what was your daily routine working in there? Were you in the squadron headquarters working?
I was in squadron headquarters and I was a clerk, you see.
Yeah.
What was
a typical day of work that you do up there then?
Well, there was the chief clerk of the squadron, and the chief clerk, Shields, Hassan Shields, who's a nice chap. Chief clerk, a lance corporal then, two clerks and a pair clerk. And when you got there in the morning, you went on at 6 o'clock, half past six, you went on parade. You could wear your shoes, you could wear your shorts, and you got collar in, and you went in front of the corporal, put your tongue up, you got your powdering tablet, And if you got malaria, you're in trouble. Of course, you didn't get it. No, I never got anything like that. And that was a ghost thing. Then you went and got your breakfast, and then put your, if you were in the squadron working in the vehicle park or in the office or anything, you just had a pair of shorts, boots, socks rolled over the top, dressed death for the day. If you were out on patrols, on patrol, you full gear on. But you never wore jungle boots unless you went in jungle. You only wore boots, you know. We had the mail to sort out first, and the chief clerks checked it and everything. And then you had to distribute it. Some had to go to the officer's mess, you know, and it depends what you did. And then he sorted the stuff that he had to do, because it was squadron stuff, you know, signals and everything. And then if there was stuff to type out, you either you got it or, you know. But the job he gave me was, because I wasn't a fully qualified clerk, because Army Act, he hadn't been when they gave you bits to add on.
The updates to it.
Yeah. And that hadn't been done for, since you were in Germany, it must have been years. He says, that's the job for you. That'll keep you happy, and I won't have to even look at it for a month. I did them. I just did them. That was it. Cut on the razor blade, cut the bits out, stuck them in.
So, Peter, let me just get this right. So you end up going sort of way away from the embarkation area. You go north to your squadron. You find your way into the squadron. Every morning at 6 o'clock, you're on parade, stick your tongue out, and you got your anti-malarial tablet. And then you spent all day updating the books that are in the chief clerk's office to the latest editions of the Army Act. And it was a cut and paste job, and you spent most of the day doing that.
Yeah, for the first week, till I did it, yeah. And you'd be a different job after that, you know. And of course, every year you had the sit-rep to do. Now, each either officer or sergeant, if he took a patrol, which was 300 cars an hour, once a month, you change all the Malay name places to English ones, you know. And I forgot what they called that singles. It was a singles wallet, a brown wallet, and it all had strips in with various, and you had to change, you know, where it is. Bukit Batu, that was the name of the section up the line, 30-odd mile up. That could be Byers Green or Bishop Auckland or Durham, you know, rather than that. And we had a rear link operator in the hut down at the base. He looked after all the signals, and the colonel. No, he wasn't a colonel. He was a major, called a Major Hand, and he would eventually end up as a brigadier. But in fact, I'm going off the whole subject, but because it was interesting, he was a good officer then, actually. And he ended up in brigadier, but he died 5 days of his 100th birthday last year. Aye, 5 days. He said Frank Henn, and I never knew what the F stood for in his initials. FRCN, you know. And I once had the sit rep. If the sit rep came in, you had to do your sit rep properly, you know. And you did your sit rep, and then you had to take it to be signed. If there was nobody about, you signed. And this day, I went down to the officer's mess with the sit rep. And when you saw the Gurkha orderlies first, and they came and got them, and he had a towel around him, a little towel around his waist, and he came to the door with a towel around his waist. I said, "The sit rep's here for signing." He said, "Oh, yes, sign the sit rep." He handed me back. He says, "Just a minute, Tupper." He said, "Do you salute an officer?" I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "I'm just telling you this because if I had nothing on," he said, "if I was bollock neck, you would still have to salute me." He says, "And it's not me, you know, to me." He said, "It's this." and it wasn't, see, they were nasty. I'm saying some people had a 2 years where they were shouted at and screamed at and all sorts. It was never like that in the 11th hours. No. And after that, I used to salute him on the stairs, salute him on the... And he says, "You can have too much of a bloody good thing, you know, for a minister." I mean, since when the colonel showed me how to shoot, I don't know. That was We're with the Gurkha Brigade, you say, but we had our own quarters. We actually got extra money, but don't tell anybody, £2 a week for messing with them, but we didn't. We had our own. But if we wanted Gurkha food, we could get it. But we had our own cooks and Malay cooks who were good. And there was two things that was against me, really. Yeah. We were on the ranges. The ranges were about a mile from the camp. There was our camps, and it was stone camp. It was a stone building. They weren't that up. They were built just before the Japanese walked into them, I think. And there was two, what they called the Kabli block, where we were at. Then there was another block, admin block, where there was a trooper, a platoon, MPs. And they had dogs as well, two dogs. They were in the next block. And then there was a medical MRS. That was the next block. And then after that, the Gurkhas had all the rest. They were pretty good. And the ranges were down from them. And the river was there and the jungle was there, and that was the ranges. And I'd fired the rifle once properly when I went to Malaya, and I never written up then. And I was laid on the ranges, and I knew I wasn't bitten much on it. Someone came and laid beside me, and he said, "It's your breathing, son." He says, "You're a little bit out of breath with lying down, probably." I says, "Yes, sir." He says, "I'll tell you what to do, and you'll do it." So I did it. It was all right. Hit the target anyway. And just after that, the sergeant major came and says, "Do you know who that was?" I says, "Go on, sir." He said, "That was the colonel. The colonel showing you up, shooting up, did he, right?" I says, "Oh, sir." He says, "On one morning, you're down here, yeah. You're with he said, "The Remy bloke will be down zeroing." He says, "You come down here with Copperstead," that he was a good shot. He says, "You come down here in Copperstead and you stop until you hit it properly." I said, "Right, sir." And he did, that was it. He never there. And neither did he think it was. We had to go on an ambush, really. It was a big village called Mawai. It was about 60 miles in the camp. And I decided to tell you what, Toba Franklin says, "You're a clerk, you know what, now put him there, then nasty work passes." He says, "We might toes up on the bread." So he says, we went along this river bank to Brow, they called it. And he said, "There's rumours of canoes coming down the river." So anyway, he says, I'll put my main cord on my leg. That's what he says, "When you're sailing, just go like that." And he says, "I'll be there." He says, "I promise you I'll be there." So anyway, it was middle of the night, and I was watching it, and I saw this coming down the river. And to me, it was somebody in a canoe. So I pulled it in, and sergeant with the building, Fox, Sergeant Fox. He let fire with them, and he ran all over them, and then those rifles and everything firing all over them. And the officer in charge, he was the fire, and he says, who started that? I said, "I did, sir." I said, "I saw a tree." Well, it wasn't a tree then, it was people to me. He said, "It was a tree trunk." The tree says, "I'm saying you shouldn't have done it, because," he says, "it did look like it." He says, "It's there." He says, "And you did the right thing." So he said, "I'm not playing out with you." I says, "All right, sir." So, but every time myself as Aunt Mary Jeff Pat used to sit and shut any good tree lately, you know, and I said, "I'm not filled barracks, does no." Aye. And now in the Hadbin paper, going down, was the village, it was a big village. Because the other thing they did wrong that weekend, they did, not me, they had San Fox and the officer, which officer I don't know. He said, "We found a billet for the night," so it was an other coat. And I thought it was nice, the carpets on the floor, you know. So they were sent out, and we had our beans in the tin and everything, yeah, and stopped there. The next morning, there was the Malay camp, so he was shouting bloody murder. And the officer had to get an interpreter. He was shouting that I like. And they said, "If you slept in the mosque," that's the mosque, you know, "and well, what an apology," you had to hear them, like, you know, "it's rolling in the bloody dust."
Peter, I hope you don't mind me saying, but
I'm getting a feeling here that you actually quite enjoyed your time with your national service. Yeah. Did you enjoy Malaya?
Oh, that's why I enjoyed it.
Yeah, you really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you get much? I mean, as a clerk, I know from my own experience, as a clerk in a squadron or in a regimental or a brigade headquarters, it's a busy little life, and you know, you see a lot happening. But what about a social life? Did you get much chance with your colleagues, fellow national servicemen?
The squadron was lucky in the fact that you could go to Singapore in a day back if you wanted, and of course, I went a few times to Singapore. It was all right, but I mean the lads in Seremban, Seremban was a nice town. It was a town, you know. There were none of the flesh pots like there was in Singapore. At least if there was. They never told us this. Oh, there's somebody close to where they are. The sergeants were all to us, you know. It was like we knew how to go on because they told you. They might call Frank from Woolerton. He was a sergeant. I never called him Frank at all, except when I would want something to drink in. Everybody had their own pub. We had a pub called the Wiley Sun, and it was a nightclub with host. Why? It's just a nightclub, you know, low-key thing with the hostesses and that. But it would be all running away. And the married sergeants, their wives are usually in Singapore, but one or two were in Johor. And they were them on a Saturday night, and we all had a drink, you know. Not every Saturday night, he couldn't afford it. It was quite good. And the other people who had their own camp was 5-11 squad, was it ROC? And they had a huge free park about a mile from where we were. Huge free, you get anything, you get armored cars, everything, you know. And it was, I don't know how big the unit was, but it was big. And the cinema was between them and us. And the Gurkhas used it mainly. It was just a wooden cinema. And mainly cowboy pictures. You could go and see cowboy pictures. The Gurkhas loved them. They had our own club, yeah, our own Nuffy club there. But we used to do Tiger and Anchor with big bottles like that. And I wasn't a drinker, you see, because I was a cyclist. I didn't drink, I didn't smoke. I was the epitome till I got there. And my mate, Scotland, Jock Brown, you got 55 free in a tin. Now, the unwritten law was you give them away, but you got $2. And that was unwritten all over the camp. So, Jim, I don't know how many dollars he owed me. I said, Jim, when are you going to pay me for them fags? Like, he says, you're not bothered about that. I says, he says, why? I says, if you don't get pay me, I'll pay. That's over. Yeah, well, you would never. I says, they opened the tin, I had the fag, and I was smoking 50 tin the day before 6 weeks. But that's just by the by, you know, but these things happen.
So how long were you in Malaya? You know, were you
then it was a 3-year Python. As you know, your regiment did 3 years.
Yeah.
And it'd been there a year and a half when I got there, so I only had a year and a half to do. And but the ironic thing about it was, when it was time to come home, I knew that they were gone, because they were becoming a training regiment at Carlisle, the 11th Hussars. And you have to be a long service to be in a fairly long service, been a long training regiment. So we'll just wait and see where we're posted to. So I wasn't posted anywhere until I got home. I had 2 weeks leave, I remember, and then they sent for me. And I went back to Boyton. I was on Boyton 6 weeks, maybe. In those 6 weeks, I went potato picking with one of the sergeants who, I didn't know him, but I got on with him well in Boyton. He says, if he asks for volunteers tomorrow morning, put your hand up. He says, I'm not. But he says, it's worth your while. Put your hand up. So I told 6 of my mates, like, you know. So when he said, we're a corporation, we said, I want 15 volunteers for tomorrow morning. So I says, put our hands up. So he says, come down and a 3-ton will pick you up and you go to a, and it was an ex-colonel's farm, you know. We got patronages and the farmer's wife used to do sausages and pull them out. And there was gypsies on, you know, And we used to let, you know, they put the pins in, and we used to move them. Well, nothing. Move the pins out of the way they less to do. And they never said it. And of course, I got enough pay to get a weekend home. That was one of the things that was good about that. And the other thing was, I was in repairing beers, and a sergeant came in, a cook sergeant, he was, I mean, and he says, I want a couple of volunteers just to help to wash up and things like that in the sergeant's mess hall. So he thought, we don't know what else. And he said, we'll put you up here, and then you might get a drink at the end if you look late. So we said, I'll go on. So we went. But before we went in, we had to go around the back, and on the front, there was a trooper out of every cavalry regiment lying in the thing, and it was worth paying just to see it, you know. The entertainment was fantastic, you know. We couldn't drive the glass for listening to the entertainment. And at the end of the night, we all got, I think it was £2, which was £2 then, and beer. You know, the beer that was in bottles and that kind. And when we didn't tell them, about the other mates that we said, what we were, marvellous. Oh, and they had a saddle shop there, they had a saddle shop. And of course, the tip was people booted each other in, and you never got to know that somebody knocked at your door on a Sunday morning and say, there's a horse outside for you. I said, oh, bloody horse. They did it regularly.
So, Peter, I really do get a sense here that, dare I say it, National Service gave you a real break from working in the foundry and the hard work you had. Malaya, as a clerk in a headquarters, you were busy, you felt like you had a real job to do. So, did you really enjoy your national time in National Service?
What they did was, in our unit anyway, they knew that the clerks were clerks, that's it. But there was loads of things that had to be done that headquarters staff could do. And some of the things were going to take over rubber plantations that were manned during the week, especially by Gurkhas, for the weekend. And then you're out again, back to work on Monday. And the other thing that I did, and a couple of mates did, there were charges that the chief clerk wrote. He was a good bloke, and it was food control. Now, every morning, you went down with the Land Rover into Johor, and a police armoured car type thing came, two policemen and an interpreter who was called Tani Tiam, and I'll never forget his name. Myself, I'd always thought he was a nice bloke with undercurrents, because I was sure he was cheating back on us, but I wasn't going to see him. I never said. And because he said to us, we'd go into some shops that pretty big, and they said, because we have to. And of course, we knew what a catty was, you know, and all that. They had to count for catties and everything, and they had to put a steak in their tin before they sold it. And they said, if someone offers you a cup of coffee, it's not a bribe. They do that, you know. So, oh, all right, all right. Or even 20 cigarettes. And so he said, just accept what's given in good grace, because that's not a bribe, which the poorer people couldn't afford to give you a bigger cup of coffee. The big shops, they took him away. They counted the cutties and everything. He wanted one, and then because he had the books, you know. And we couldn't do the books. And he spoke. He was an educated lad. And he was doing it for money, of course. And he said his father had a teak plantation up in the north of Malaya, and he'd been to college and everything. And he was filling in to get some money, and which was true. But I enjoyed that to a certain point, going around places. And till one day we were at a plantation. And there was a little shop, and there was the chap owned the place. His son, who was about 12 or 14, he was doing the work, you know. Stan says, you'll have to put this down as I doing it then. He was short of so many carries of rice, two tins of beans, something like that. I says, it's only really 12 and old man fat. He says, doesn't matter how old he is, he's doing that. His father can't read or really write. He owned it, but he couldn't read or write. And I says, what'll happen? He says, well, you go to court. I says, well, I says, they're not put a kid like that. He says, oh, yes, they will.
But what happened with you? Did you left the army at that point, did you? You left the
army. I was discharged from Bullington.
Yeah. And where did you go after that? You know, did you make your way home? You had a period of leave?
I went back home. I had leave. I went back to the forge. I went back to work. And that's really good. And I knew that they weren't for too fussed about me, you know. Because I wasn't nasty about the forge. I just let it be known that there were better things than the forge. And for some people, that was enough for their lives, but it wasn't for me. As I say, I got a job at Smart and Drums, and it was a good job. So I used to run on the assembly line with 100 women, you know, and 5 men. And somebody said, that's not a job, it's a nightmare. I said, actually.
But you you may have finished your national service, but your time with the military wasn't over, was it? No, I mean, am I right in thinking that after that you volunteered and joined the Territorial Army?
Yes, I was in the Territorial Army. I was driving when I went in with the RASC. But because I was a clerk, when I went to the RAMC, instructor, well, I forgot the whole name. He was a good bloke. And he said, have you been a clerk, Franklin? I said, because I was in the RCT then, still in. And I said, I have. I said, it's a bit since I've done it. He's never right. He says, I haven't got a clerk. He says, he's gone. He says, he's got money and moved away. He says, are you going to have a go at it? And I said, oh, go at it. It's something different. I went as clerk there, and I ended up as chief clerk, really, by the time I'd finished. But the odd thing about not being a staff sergeant was that one of the lads who was a signaller, he was a full sergeant, and he was older than me. He wanted to be a staff sergeant.
But you eventually end up with the medical corps. How did you go from Royal Army Service Corps and Corps of Transport into the medical corps? How did that come about?
The chap who was... what was he? He was a staff sergeant, Stace, they called him. And as I said, he got back me and said, have you done a clerk's course? Because I had.
That's how you got there?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And how long did you do with the Territorial Army?
22 years.
So what year did you finish with them? What year would you...
80s. 85. No, I was in Crusader. I remember that?
Yes.
Crusader 80. And the other one in 85. I was in that one. So it must have been after that, 86. I know I'd asked for an extension. I was 45. I asked for an extension.
Peter, as we've just chatted, several times you spoke about, I was a cyclist. You said that you didn't drink a great deal when you had your national service because you were a cyclist. What? Tell me a little bit about your time as a cyclist.
Well, as soon as I started work, I asked my mother to put a deposit down on a racing bike at a shop called Godfrey Whitworth in Michigan. And I got this racing bike, and I started just to go out on my own, just round the doors, more or less, you know. And then one Sunday, I went to Barnard Castle. And, of course, I didn't know it was 15 miles or anything. I just went. And I was coming back, and a whole mob of cyclists passed us. And two lads sort of dropped off the back, right? Oh, okay. I said, yeah. They said, do you know where? I said, no. I said, Spurrier Wheelers. Right. They were fairly famous, you know, cyclists, racing cyclists. So he said, if you ever want to come across, come to me. We'll meet so and so and that. But I lived at Bishop then, so it was, you know, I didn't go there immediately. I was in. Mr. Morgan, the cycling club, for a while, we had met in a pub, and there was about 15 of us all together, and we went out every Sunday, 9 o'clock start from the marketplace, come back, well, God knows what time, you know. But the runs were all made out ahead. And different pubs and different hotels would make you tea. Just tea, and you took your own sandwiches and you had your tea. Or you could have a pint if you wanted. But most of them were underage, so therefore it was tea. And when I was secondary, I had a book, a thick book, with all the places in, and every week you chose somewhere different, away from, you know, and it was good. And then they had cycling tours. We had cycle tours. We went to youth hostel. Once a month we went to a different youth hostel, Lakes, Scotland, all over the place, and it was good. It was a good day for that.
So this was before you even joined the army that you was active, so, yeah?
Probably, yeah. And the lad that I spoke to about the KDG, you know, that he was in the cycling club and he was good. And the odd thing about it was, when he finished, he'd done his 3 years. He did 3 years and 22 years, 3 options. He did his 3 years and he was corporal. And when he came out, he joined the police force at Carlisle. And I don't know how long he was in, but the next time I met him, he was a warrant officer in the Rini. He'd gone back in. And of course, he was a skilled fitter turner. And he says, I got from what play that paid this. Who do you say? He did a tour of Malaya on an inspectorate. You know, he did the inspectorate there.
And this is a good close friend from the cycling club. Yeah.
He died last year, see?
Yeah. And you're cycling. I mean, I'm going to guess that when you left the army, you carried on and picked your...
I got to work a tandem. Me and my wife had a tandem.
And did...
to Germany.
And am I right in thinking that your wife was Frances and you met your wife through cycling?
Yeah, she was in the cycling club. She went out with the lads, you know. Well, there was a few girls, not just to her. But, we went to some port holidays. Went to Ireland first, and Scotland and Wales, and then Germany, Italy, Austria. There was a train goes from Cully to Innsbruck overnight. We did that a couple of times. And then got off there and went round the mountain passes. What they do on the Tour de France. But we used to walk most of them. And then when we got to the last mile, we used to put in the lowest gear we could find and ride up on it.
I understand you met Frances before you went to your national service. And
yes.
And can you remember meeting her? Can you remember the day that you actually met her?
I used to meet every Sunday, you know, at the cycling club, and we'd just have to chat. And then eventually we used to call them the cycling. I went back and go to the cinema, Odeon on a Sunday night. And I went there a couple of times. And
when did you get married with Frances? Was that after...
1957, after I'd done my national service.
So after your national service. And can I ask you, Peter, how long you were married before you sadly lost Frances?
63 years.
As we close, I want to thank Peter for his time in sharing his story with us today. And for ending on such a moving reflection of his marriage to Frances. They first met through cycling, and then they shared 63 years of life together. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on Peter's remarkable journey. From his national service with the Hussars in Malaya, to decades of commitment with the Territorial Army, and his lifelong passion for cycling through the roads of County Durham and beyond, Peter's story is a testament to service, dedication, and the joy of finding purpose both in and out of uniform. But remember, these aren't just stories from the past, they're a living legacy. By following, listening, and sharing the podcast, you're helping to ensure these voices are heard, remembered, and honoured for future generations. So please follow Veterans Voices UK on your favourite podcast platform, leave a review, and consider sharing this episode with someone who may appreciate Peter's inspiring story. To find out how you can support the podcast and get involved in future episodes, visit our website at www.veteransvoices.uk. But most of all, thank you for being part of our community. We look forward to welcoming you next time. Until then, I'm Matt Lim. And this has been Veterans Voices UK.